Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll be talking in a moment with Will Bunch, the author of Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. In other words, we'll be talking about the long-term changes in our economy and our politics that brought about the current disaster. And then also talk later about why Obama won the making of the president 2008, and how this president will and can succeed with the new form of politics that he's discovered and generated, and how long these people that have supported him will stay with him as he faces this very uncertain future that we're all facing. I'm speaking with Will Bunch, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. His numerous articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, The American Prospect, American Journalism Review, and elsewhere. He's a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of its popular blog,
Attitude.
Attitude. I just got it. Well,
South Philadelphia way of saying attitude.
That's ATTYTOOD. And his new book is Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. And I was just mentioning here that we were trying to set up today's program, Will, with an economist to give us some of the insight into what might happen on Monday or Tuesday. It looks like the new Secretary of Treasury, Timothy Geithner, is going to postpone his announcements of how he may bail out banks in the future till Tuesday. But what we do know is that this is a situation that people haven't seen since the 1930s, since the 1929-1933 period. And I know that in your new book, Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future, to some extent explains the long-range genesis of the problem. Just to talk about the current situation, which I really do believe is unprecedented, and what is particularly depressing is that the gravity of the situation is in stark contrast to the fatuous nature of the political debate that we witnessed in the last week. I've never felt more alienated and disconnected from our political leadership than at this particular moment in time.
Yes, well that, I think that's understandable, and I think some of that is there was a lot of enthusiasm and excitement when President Obama was inaugurated. And what we've been seeing in the last 2 weeks has been so much of the same old, same old. And I think the media, you know, the inside the Beltway media is responsible for some of that. And I think a lot of it is just the structure of conservative politics in this country, the echo chamber that really starts with right-wing talk radio and just has such incredible sway over the remaining Republican members of Congress. It's really deeply rooted in this Reagan myth machine that the only thing that works, the only solution to anything, is to try approaches that they believe are rooted in tradition of Ronald Reagan. I mean, it's fascinating to me because when I started writing this book, Tear Down This Myth, about a year ago, it was inspired by the 2008 presidential campaign and how the candidates running for president, in both parties really, but especially, of course, on the Republican side, seemed to spend more time talking about how they would be the next Ronald Reagan than what they would do about the subprime mortgage crisis, about the, at the time, high gas prices, about ending the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What I was a little bit worried about was whether Ronald Reagan would be quite as relevant once the election was over. And instead, I think as you alluded to in your comments, he's more relevant than ever. I mean, we had a jobs bill before Congress that the original intention of which was to put people to work by spending money on all these things that have been neglected really since the age of Ronald Reagan, spending money to rebuild our infrastructure and fix all these roads and bridges that have been allowed to crumble, money to spend on mass transit, which has just been horrendously taken care of in this country for the last couple of generations. Money to develop research in alternative energy, which would totally undo Reaganism. Ronald Reagan was the president who destroyed wind power and solar power funding in this country, and even ripped the solar panels off the roof of the White House. So that's what we started with, and then the conservative echo chamber led by Rush Limbaugh kicked in and said, well, no, we all know the only thing that helps turn the economy around is tax cuts, putting money in people's pockets, even though every economist that's looked at this has said that, and it's been studied very thoroughly, that the way to create jobs is through a spending program. That spending program, I think, gets back $1.50 for every dollar you spend. A tax cuts, it's less than a dollar because people save the money. People use it to pay down the enormous debts that people have, which are okay things, but we really need to deal with this job situation so we don't have another Great Depression. And you saw in the last week, Ronald Reagan invoked several times on the floor of Congress to change this plan, and lo and behold, it has been changed. It's more heavily weighted towards tax cuts, some of which are for things like capital gains and things like corporations that benefit the wealthier classes, and it's away from creating jobs. And I'm very terrified at the effect if this stimulus program doesn't work, and it may not work as it's now constructed.
But are these people really, do they really believe this stuff? I mean, I get the impression that this whole Reagan experience and the fact that we still have this echo chamber that's out there repeating this tired, discredited ideology in the face of manifest failure, it seems to me that this has always been, these people have always been shilling for the powerful and the plutocrats, and that's what Reagan was. He was a shill. He used to be. I remember getting a tape from a 1948 campaign that he was campaigning for Harry Truman, and he was a rabid leftist, and his speeches were identical to the ones that he got elected on, except all you had to do was change one word. He railed against big corporations in 48, and then when Nancy and her father and others turned him into a shill for the powerful corporate interests and the moneyed interests, he then railed against big government. But it was the same speech.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you mentioned something that very few people are aware of, which is that Nancy Davis. Nancy Reagan, her family was very much into right-wing politics, and her Ronald Reagan's father-in-law from his second marriage was a big Barry Goldwater supporter. So that was a factor. The other thing, which I don't believe you mentioned, is that he, at a low point in his career, was hired to become the pitch man for General Electric and to go around the country giving pep talks to General Electric employees. And he fell under the sway of this philosophy that General Electric and some of his executives were really pioneering at the time, which was to take this now middle-class, working-class in America that was really prospering in the wake of FDR's New Deal and these more progressive programs, and to make them a force for conservative, a force for defense spending and anti-unionism and a more conservative message. And that was the mission that Ronald Reagan had for 10 years during the 50s. And he got it down well. He developed what became known as the speech, which he finally gave in 1964 on behalf of Barry Goldwater, and that's what propelled him to become governor of your state, California.
Right,
and
but the purpose of what he was doing, though, which leads us to the moment we're in, was all about the destroying the middle class. It may not have been the intention. It's hard to know, but at the end of the day, Reagan and the people that backed him are kind of medievalists. They don't believe in a middle class. They believe in a strong military, strong church, and an aristocracy or a timocracy, as the Greeks called it, the rule of money. And he basically has been one of the greatest instruments in destroying the middle class. And we still have this cherished myth that we are a middle-class country, and both candidates in the last election ran on this cherished myth of being a middle-class country. But the truth of the matter is over 50% of the people in this country earn less than $30,000 a year, and some considerably less. In fact, Europeans on welfare earn more, and they get 6 weeks vacation to boot, than most working-class Americans. We have a huge working class, underpaid, undereducated, and overworked. Now they're unemployed in increasing numbers. So they're just being thrown away like refuse. And it all started with Reagan, because before Reagan, people were encouraged to save, and there were these sort of middle-class values. The whole purpose of much of what Roosevelt did with the GI Bill and what the UAW achieved in terms of bringing people from the working class into the middle class is what Reagan and his corporate masters organized this frontal attack against. And the most pernicious thing that they did was they instead of saving, which we don't do anymore, they created this entire economy based on credit, so that people's standard of living would be artificially maintained through credit. But it has become a massive form of bondage, and now it's economically unsustainable.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's funny because basically the 1980s, it happened on two different levels. It happened, as I talk about in my book, Tear Down This Myth, it happened, people were encouraged to live on credit, and the savings rate, which you know, Reagan had bragged when he ran for president that with his tax cuts, the savings would increase in this country, and of course it decreased dramatically. And at the same time, the government was the same way. The government, the federal debt tripled during Reagan's presidency from only a trillion. Now it's about 10 trillion, but it was a trillion at that time to 3 trillion. And the message that the Reagan administration sent to people was, you know, it's okay to live on borrowed means, that it's okay to live on credit. Just one thing I wanted to add to your point that you just made is you're right about the middle class and the destruction of the middle class. What I think is so fascinating about Reagan and this whole movement is that to try and do this successfully in a democracy and at least keep the basic tenets of a democracy going, regardless of how undemocratic the outcomes might be at some time, you had to enlist members of the working class to vote for their own destruction, basically. I mean, this has been the theme of a number of books in recent years, like What's the Matter with Kansas by Thomas Frank is a prime example of that. The way that during the 50s and 60s that many people in the working class were convinced to vote against, certainly clearly to vote against their own economic interests, but I think in a lot of cases to vote against their broader interests. And this was done through, you know, fear, through playing on resentment that came out of all the tumult of the civil rights era of the 1960s and some of the riots like the one that you had in Watts in 1965, which was instrumental in helping Reagan get elected the year after that as governor. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, and I know one thing we wanted to talk about today was just about the public relations gimmickry and mastery of the Reagan years, because his ability in bringing this kind of Hollywood backlot sensibility to the presidency, I think was a powerful part of how he was able to do that.
Right, but his record as a union, he was the head of the SAG for a while, and he presided over the biggest sellout in union history, which was that in the early days of television, the TV companies, before they found out that they could actually print money, had to actually produce product to fill up this enormous amount of airtime, and the stuff wasn't particularly good. And the way they really were able to fill up most of their airtime was by recycling the vaults of the Hollywood studios by running movies. And Reagan made sure that none of the actors got any residuals from all of their earlier work. So his function was always to sell out the working class and the middle class at the behest of the plutocrats. And this is, I think, the genius, surely, and you alluded to this, Will Bunch, is that the Democrats forget that the only way Republicans ever get elected in this country is with Democratic votes, and that the genius of Reagan and the people that groomed him was that he created this so-called phenomenon called the Reagan Democrats, and he was able to peel off all these working class people to vote Republican. And that has been essentially the success of the Republican Party. The Democrats have a natural constituency because there are more working people in this country than there are millionaires.
I think the flip side of that and how that's played out over time and how that eventually allowed Barack Obama to get elected president in 2008 is the fact that the conservative manipulation of the working class became so cynical and so based upon a lack of reason, a war against science, certainly when it comes to things like climate change and fossil fuel supplies and energy policy and that sort of thing, built upon religious orientation towards politics, that there was so much of this that eventually I think the more educated people in this country, the people who've been to college, and of course the number of people, the percentage of people attending college has steadily increased in this country. And it's interesting that now you see the Democrats getting more and more votes every election from middle class and even upper middle class college educated and professional school educated people, whereas the Republicans are still tailoring this pitch. Like Sarah Palin is a prime example, I think, of somebody whose pitch was directed straight towards kind of a talk radio audience. Just very unsophisticated, very emotional, trying to play on people's fears and resentments, which was certainly a strategy when you had somebody running to be the first African American president to do that. And thankfully for this country, it didn't work. But I think you're seeing an evolution to some degree away from the game, from the playbook that worked in the 80s and the 90s. But we're not quite there yet, and you're seeing this play out in Congress today with this debate over the stimulus package. The Republicans are taking a position that is really highly illogical, that they want to hijack a jobs program and turn it into something that is not going to create that many jobs. And unfortunately, with that one extra vote that they have in the Senate to filibuster, they're getting away with it. So I think the more we can talk about the Reagan myth and about how these solutions that have become so ingrained aren't really working, I think the better we'll have a chance of moving on and moving forward.
Well, but the people who should be making it clear how bankrupt, how illogical, how corrupt the position is from these people who created this massive problem, the scope of which we still don't know. We don't really know how deep this abyss that we're staring into and how desperately needed this stimulus package is, and how it may well not even meet the challenge of this deteriorating economy and the speed with which it's deteriorating and the extent to which much of the problems are hidden because you compare how that $700 billion went out the door under Bush and Paulson, where basically everybody was told just to shut up and vote for it, and that money went God knows where. We're going to be talking with Elizabeth Warren about it. They're trying to find out what happened. The alacrity with which that money was spent, and how much they're haggling over this next batch of money, which is actually supposed to stimulate the economy, not bail out the misdeeds of Wall Street. I don't understand what's wrong with the Democrats. It's their job to point out how corrupt and bankrupt these people are. Why they're so collegial, it's almost like the Stockholm Syndrome, that they're being nice to their torturers, because the more you're nice to these guys on the other side, the more they get mean. I mean, there's no such thing as bipartisanship. So why the hell didn't they just say, okay, you guys filibuster, call their bluff?
Right. I would have liked to have seen that. You're right. I think they're slowly getting the message. Unfortunately, we don't have time for slowly, but I think President Obama's speech Thursday night down in Virginia was a start, where he went to the American people. He said, what do you mean it's a spending program? What do you think a stimulus package is? And I think he got a big laugh, and I think people really responded to that line. And I think people responded to the idea that more tax cuts is not a solution to the to the type of problem we're facing. So, and supposedly, you know, he's going to get out of Washington this week. He's going to go to Indiana. I think he's going to another state, perhaps Ohio. I forget which one, but
Indiana. You know, yeah.
Yeah, I know he starts in Indiana, and yeah. And the president needs to get out of D.C. One point I make, and it's kind of interesting, is, you know, is toxic. In effect, as I think a lot of Reagan-inspired policies have had on this country, both when Reagan was president and the day since, and certainly as they were, you know, adopted and kind of bastardized by George W. Bush during his presidency, as bad as those effects are, I do think that President Obama can look at some of the methods that Ronald Reagan used to sell his programs and adapt them to a sensible, right-thinking political agenda, but use these methods to sell them. One of them is, well, the main one really is going over the head of Congress, going to the American people. I mean, President Obama still has this enormous wellspring of public goodwill and public support, and he's crazy if he doesn't tap into that. I think he spent too much of his first 2 weeks in office, you know, in Washington, trying to foster the spirit of bipartisanship, trying to get along with these people who, like I said, you know, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. It's just not working. And I think he's realizing that. I think having this press conference on TV tomorrow night and then getting out of D.C. is going to maybe help him sell his message to the public and maybe put some pressure on these people. And I don't think he should get one more vote than he needs to get this through. I mean, I don't think he needs to craft a program that's going to get 10 or 20 Republican votes, because that's going to be the only thing they're going to accept is something that's just going to have more tax cuts for corporations, more capital gains taxes. We don't need that. That's not going to create any jobs in this country. So that's the message of tear down this myth. I mean, I think it's a timely title, you know, that this myth of Ronald Reagan, that the only thing that ever helps the American economy is another tax cut, is killing us.
Well, he also believed that you've got to put the handcuffs on the welfare queens and take the handcuffs off the businessmen and get rid of all these regulations and free up the spirit of entrepreneurship and all this stuff, which has ended up with his wholesale criminality. I don't know what it is about this idea of the deregulation ends up with enormous, you know, that Jack Kennedy said, the rising tide raises all boats. A handful of people, I mean, only a few thousand, have destroyed the entire global economy and taken millions of people down and thrown people into the street and they're living in their cars. This is what's happening here. This is what happens when you deregulate and take away the watchdogs who were put in there in 1933 after the last time it went to hell in a handbasket. I mean,
right. Well, I think you have a couple things going on here. I mean, you have the deregulation. Also, the other thing about his big tax cut in 1981 was, you know, it dramatically decreased taxes on the top 1% on the most affluent. And one of the things that happened is this whole issue of runaway CEO pay. When Reagan took office as president, the average CEO, I think, made 35 times more than the average worker in his company. Today, that number is over 400. And, you know, initially companies said, well, the tax rates are pretty high on wealthy people. Why should we bother paying our CEOs that much money? When the wealthy had a chance to suddenly keep so much of what they earned, look what happened. I mean, people went wild. But the other thing is deregulation. One of the things that I obviously bring back up and tear down this myth is the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s, which really was a precursor of what we're seeing today, in the sense that savings and loans, which had been these conservative, well-regulated institutions for decades, were given carte blanche under Reagan to go wild, and you immediately saw all this type of insider dealing, all kinds of corruption, just shoddy loan practices to try and make a quick buck, and the federal taxpayer ended up paying $150 billion to It was the original bailout program. Right. We had to bail out these SNLs.
Now it's up in the trillions. The
same. Right, yeah.
Exactly the same mechanism, by the way. To be fair to Reagan, it wasn't just Reagan and
no.
his zeal to deregulate. It was the crooked Congress, the Democratic Congress, Fannin St. James from Rhode Island and others that were huge enablers. Just as getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act and other actions by the Democrats at the behest of Phil Gramm, the Republican senator, who pushed all this stuff through. So there's complicity here that, you know,
And don't forget the Democratic presidents. We've had Jimmy Carter actually started a lot of deregulation of industries like the airlines. And then you're right. I mean, a lot of the major banking deregulation took place at the end of the Clinton administration. So with a lead role for Congress.
Right.
So,
to be fair to Reagan, as much as I think that everything we're saying is extremely important and necessary for people to get over this propaganda and start realizing the genesis of the unraveling of the American middle class and the extent to which this guy's been a shill for the wealthy who have taken us all for a ride and created this whole class of people who get paid hundreds of millions of dollars for failing, which is something that is unprecedented in the world. This is, you know, he did do extraordinary things on the international arena, particularly ending the Cold War, which he did in conjunction with Gorbachev. A story for another day.
Gorbachev. Well, I mean, there's a whole long section in Tear Down This Myth. One of the things that's interesting about Reagan on the foreign policy front, just quickly, is that I mean, he had a very sincere desire to get rid of nuclear weapons, probably more so than any president we've had, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, whatever. He hated nuclear weapons. He felt he was on a personal mission to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And to his credit, he did more than any president ever
exactly.
had to do that. Yeah. One thing that's fascinating is, I mean, he was under a lot of political pressure in his first term from the nuclear freeze movement, which almost seems like a footnote today, but actually was very active at the time.
I was one of the organizers. I know it well.
Right, and so you know that the, for example, the event that they held in Central Park in New York was the largest political rally ever held in this country then or since. So you remember the movie, the ABC TV movie, The Day After.
Right.
That movie had a huge impact on Ronald Reagan. You know, other conservatives are out there railing against this liberal movie from liberal Hollywood. And Ronald Reagan watched that movie at Camp David. He wrote in his diary, you know, watching this movie left me greatly depressed. It made me more determined to get an arms deal than ever. And he really worked hard on that. And, you know, he was able to get a whole class of missiles out of Europe and start the talks that led to, like, a broader strategic nuclear arms reduction. He actually sent a telegram to the producer of The Day After when he signed his major INF nuclear treaty with the Soviets, and he said, "Don't think that you didn't have anything to do with this, because you did." So he deserves some credit for that. You know, the thing about the Reagan myth that I make in the book is the Reagan myth, or what you might call Reaganism, which is kind of the 21st century interpretation of Ronald Reagan by the conservative movement, by talk radio, and by Sean Hannity, and by, you know, some of the congressional leaders of the Republicans, is really much more dangerous than Reagan himself was, because so many things are undertaken in the name of Ronald Reagan that he himself would not have done. I honestly, sincerely do not believe that Ronald Reagan would have invaded Iraq in 2003, given all the facts that we had at that time. That was not his style. He didn't believe you know, in risking American lives for something specious.
No, he got out of Lebanon real quick.
But some of his rhetoric that he used in the Cold War, and it really was rhetoric mainly against the Soviets, you know, was used to justify that invasion. I think Bush's 2002 Axis of Evil speech was very much inspired by Reagan's remark about the evil empire.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your book, Will Bunch, Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on your show. It was a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot. Well, Will Bunch, the author of Tear Down This Myth, How the Reagan Legacy Has Distorted Our Politics and Haunts Our Future. Greg Mitchell is the editor of editor and publisher, a journal of the newspaper business, which has won several major awards for its coverage of Iraq in the media. He's written 9 books, including Hiroshima in America with Robert J. Lifton and The Campaign of the Century, Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor of California and the Birth of Media Politics. And his articles have appeared in dozens of leading newspapers and magazines, including The New York Times, The Washington Post. He blogs at The Huffington Post, Talking Points Memo, and has a regular column at editorandpublisher.com. His recent book was So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed in Iraq. And his new book just published is Why Obama Won, The Making of a President, 2008. And this is the first book exploring the 2008 campaign and its aftermath from a liberal perspective. Why Obama Won focuses on new media versus old media, grassroots versus GOP, lessons for the future, and all of the controversies and conflicts from Jeremiah the Preacher to Joe the Plumber. Stephen Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Media in reporting says every copy sold will make Ann Coulter cry. Well, that's reason enough, I should say, to get the book. and the idea that there are even people like Ann Coulter and Joe the Plumber even taken seriously. I mean, we're already at an enormous deficit if we're in a political culture where people who are so manifestly absurd are taken seriously. Do you think that's changing, Greg? Because I noticed that when Coulter came out for her last sort of pseudo-provocative, nonsensical gibberish on the media to sell books and to grab some headlines, most people didn't take the bait this time.
Well, I think a lot of what my book focuses on is the beginning of the marginalization of the Ann Coulters of the world. Obviously, they still have influence. She still sells books to her audience. She's still Fox News is obviously still still has a big audience. But what really happened in the 2008 election was the real explosion of the influence and power of the new media, of the electronic campaigning, social networking, public radio. All the what I would call the alternative forms of influence, and it was quite we'd seen it going back to 2004, 2006, but 2008, it really was one of the main reasons for Obama's victory and organizing so many people. And the book continually comes back to that. It kind of contrasts the old media and the new media, so you kind of get these outrages, continual outrages, in the old media. And then the sort of the counterweight of the new media, if you want to include The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert, you could do that also. So let's put fake news in there as well. But like I said, to me the message of the 2008 campaign and what's covered repeatedly in the book is this sort of very encouraging signs of a counterweight to the to the Ann Coulters of the world.
But Greg Mitchell, the story that you've told in your book, Why Obama Won, The Making of the President, 2008, if we look at the present, all of the stuff that you've just mentioned, it feels like the person who pulled off this extraordinary feat and created this amazing coalition, and both in terms of new ways to finance campaigns but also new ways to get the message out, and the person that motivated a whole generation of young voters who normally don't participate, has suddenly walked into this buzzsaw known as Washington, D.C.
Right.
And you can see how the old media have given more airtime to the Republicans, and particularly Rush Limbaugh, than they have to Obama. Right. So much for the honeymoon.
Well, I think that's why we've seen in recent days, there've been a lot of publicity or some publicity that the Obama campaign apparatus, which usually disappears after a successful campaign, actually the same person who ran the campaign, that arm of it, is still maintains this army of Obama people that were organized in the campaign, and much has been made of the email lists and the fundraising lists and these millions of people ready to lobby. In fact, they were criticized months ago by the right wingers that there was somehow there was something unethical or unfair about having this army of people to lobby citizen lobbyists, I guess. But it seems like maybe understandably Obama, taking office, making these appointments, and coming in, he didn't really hit the ground running in terms of realizing that the country really is in almost a post 9/11 situation in terms of a crisis, and that there really was not a day to spare, and that instead of bending over backwards to try to win votes from the Republicans, and then he ended up getting nothing. He might have used the bully pulpit, and mobilized. What's the equivalent of the bully pulpit today is the mailing list, the email list, the social networking, and gotten his army out there to push for the stimulus plan instead of negotiating with Republicans who ended up not helping him at all. So, I think the book does draw, does draw a distinction between how you organize a campaign, and then what happens when you come to office, and it is a whole different game.
Right. Well, I just apropos of the moment, Greg, because I think it's extraordinary to recognize the tenuous nature of our economy. We're in the sort of in a fool's paradise here, in the calm before the storm. Enjoying a standard of living that may evaporate before our eyes because of the malpractice of people who have eroded the very foundation of our economy, and we don't quite know the damage they've done. But we know that Monday or Tuesday, Geithner's going to call for a new bank bailout regime,
right,
which may. They may not even be able to capitalize some of these banks that are about to fail, like B of A and Citicorp. They may have to come up with some kind of form of insurance or something. But we are in an unprecedented crisis. And you compare the nature of the crisis with the quality of the debate that went on last week and is continuing in Washington. It is disgusting. And now,
and again, in the book, I repeatedly bring up these things. Look at the level of the. Look at the level of the debate of the debates, of the presidential debates that we saw last fall, and even the Obama-Clinton debates. I mean, to me, it was just appalling to see how the network anchors and the other people from the traditional networks who were the moderators and the people who were organizing the debates in terms of the questions and everything else, one after another, whether it was Charlie Gibson to all the way to good old Tom Brokaw, George Stephanopoulos, I mean, they brought such disgrace on themselves. The way they handled these debates, the questions were often focusing on flag pins and things like that. What happened this year that was actually pretty remarkable was in radio stations like yours, and of course many websites and blogs. People weighed in quickly. There was a counterweight to this, the way these debates were handled. And if you remember, as the book recalls, every single one of the debates, the four debates in the fall, the traditional pundits on TV were saying that they were a draw, or McCain did well, or it looks like he may get some momentum going, or whatever. And then when the opinions came in from the web and from radio and from polls. This year, for the first time, there were these scientific surveys, not just internet phone, voting thing, focus groups and scientific surveys, CNN and Gallup and all the rest, that within 45 minutes of the end of the debates, they were all showing that in each case, the Democrat had won in a landslide. So you had this, what I would call, egg on the face, public humiliation, with the TV pundits who had just been talking for 45 minutes about how it was a draw and surely it might help McCain and so on and so forth, and then almost with a gulp sort of reporting one focus group after another or one survey showing that the Democrat actually carried the day by 2-1 or 3-1.
Right.
I mean, to me, that was just a public humiliation of the old media.
Well, I think, though, the problem here is one that we were alluding at earlier, Greg Mitchell, and that is that nobody wants to you know, say the emperor has no clothes, and nobody wants to point out the utter bankruptcy and absurdity of people like Ann Coulter and Joe the Plumber, and that also applied to Sarah Palin. I mean, that was thoroughly embarrassing that somebody like that could actually be taken seriously as a possible presidential candidate, and even could inherit a presidency. That was the scariest thing of all. And
well, that was you know, again, you had the in that.
But it took. With all due credit to Katie Couric, she didn't do anything except ask this idiot questions, which she was totally incapable of answering. I think without Jon Stewart and without Tina Fey and Saturday Night Live, you know, the mainstream press would have dignified this gun-toting cracker from the frigid North.
What also happened because of the web and again the new media was one of the key things was that the Palin's hometown newspaper, the Anchorage Daily News, which I doubt if anyone in the lower 48 has ever held in their hands, but in the new day of the web, the Anchorage Daily News immediately had numerous articles and also editorials about Palin, about her background, about her record, about ethical problems, and so on and so forth, that were picked up. I mean, at editor and publisher, I ran many stories. I like to think I had a little bit something to do with spreading the word and getting people tuned into the Anchorage paper. But once the mainstream media and radio and the web got tuned into what the Anchorage paper was coming out with, their factual reports on the on her background and everything really started to change the narrative even before kind of laid the groundwork. But for that first couple weeks, when you had one pundit after another taking her seriously, and even that I have that in the book, I trace the whole episode, which again highly revealing, I think, in October. David Brooks of the New York Times, who had written a column sort of half-praising, half-criticizing Palin, but basically taking her seriously, told a public in a what was supposed to be sort of an obscure panel in New York City, where he actually on the panel said that she was totally unqualified, even for vice president, let alone president, totally ridiculous. And yet, even though I wrote three columns about it, he never put that in print at the New York Times. He never, it's true, he wasn't a tremendous booster of her, but he never in print came anywhere close to the negative feelings. He couldn't have been more negative, saying she was totally unqualified. So why wouldn't, if people felt this way, what kept David Brooks from actually saying that Sarah Palin was unqualified and a joke? Why was she sort of taken as as a serious candidate? And I think that's, again, very revealing of the narrow band. Thankfully, there's stations like yours and other places which extend the band of punditry and information out there. But in most cases, it's a very, very narrow band, sort of in the middle and towards the right.
Well, Greg, since you cover the newspaper business as editor of Editor and Publisher, we, of course, experiencing the demise of the LA Times here, which this kind of corporate raider took over, borrowed money from the pension plans of the employees, and then turned around and fired them. His MO is pretty clear, that he's a kind of vulture, a predator, who tries to pick off assets and dispose of them. And apparently he can't even do that because he's borrowed so much, and the economy's turned south so badly. The other big paper, the New York Times, it has a different story, which is that the scion, Sulzberger, the kid, is a complete moron, and he's made incredibly bad investments and put the entire paper in jeopardy. What troubles me is that I don't believe that you can replace the New York Times with blogs, because the purpose of a newspaper and the way they operate is they have editors, they have fact checkers.
Right.
The journalist does the first draft, but they make sure that what they print is sourced and backed up. The opposite's true of bloggers. They put stuff out, and then it takes weeks before everybody realizes a lot of it's garbage. So it's the reverse process. And I'd hate to see us lose these big institutions that set a kind of standard of journalism.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, I mentioned the Anchorage paper earlier. That's exactly exactly a good point, because they had the factual record going back, you know, a decade or more, and they did more reporting on the ground, and you brought up things about the Troopergate scandal and all sorts of things. So if it hadn't been for that kind of, you know, record and also ongoing probing of Palin up there in Alaska, you know, the election might have been over before we learned, learned very much. So certainly the, you know, the blogs and the pundits and the actual reporters actually getting the stories need to rely on each other. And it really would be a bad thing if real journalism continues to subside, because it just can't be replaced by people spouting opinions. And, you know, what are people linking to mainly on the web? They're linking to actual real articles. If they're just going to be linking back and forth to other people's opinions, it's not going to do much good.
Yeah, I had Craig Newmark on the other day, I think last week, the owner and founder of Craigslist. And, of course, he's been blamed as the guy that's destroyed the newspaper business. He wasn't prepared to take that rap, needless to say.
Yeah.
But it is a very, very sad moment for the newspaper business. We're here today to try and raise money to keep this station going in an incredibly bad economy. And the purpose of doing these interviews is to point out to people that actually you get pretty good value for money here in terms of information.
It's much needed. It's part of the part of what people need to get out of this, because I've both in the new book and previous books and ongoing. My daily work, very free to criticize the old media, and but in the same time, we want to have the good journalism continue as well as boost and help survive the alternate voices and the way people get information and opinions, and certainly more than ever that has to be done. So.
Well, the environment, though, I think is just, as I say, we've seen the destruction of the LA Times by this sort of corporate vulture. we're beginning to see the demise of the New York Times because of the incompetence of its owner and the bad business decisions he's made and the huge debt that he has to service. And we don't have a BBC over here. I mean, Nixon set up PBS to fail. NPR's begging for money and always has to be nice to the political people who control the purse strings. So this is about the last bit of the spectrum where nobody owns it except the people who are supposed to be calling in. But in terms of the landscape that we've been laying out here, Greg Mitchell, since you're the editor and publisher, which is a journal of the newspaper business, we know the newspaper business is in huge trouble, and to lose the journalistic standard that the New York Times set because of mismanagement, and the ones that have the successful models are these outrageous, you know, the Pravda of the Republican Party, the Fox News, which is a complete propaganda outfit, but obviously run by a pretty smart businessman. That's what's going to take over. I mean, there will be no news. I mean, the people that there's no obligation in the law, in our society, in the politics, there's no obligation on the part of anybody to tell the American people the truth.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's no charter like the BBC has, where they're politically insulated because their revenues come from every time people buy TVs and radios. We don't have a system like that here.
Right. And that's why you need to support the Amy Goodmans and the Bill Moyers, and you know, there are people. Everyone can pick their favorites or identify their handful of people, but you know, there are some people who need support and need your dollars. And so it's very important to keep that going in this day and age. And more than that, I think that another reason people need to listen to your program and others is, you know, Obama wants to send 30,000, or I can say wants to, plans to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. So this is, you know, it'd be nice to think that Obama took office, started pulling us out of Iraq right away, and this the nightmare was coming to a close. But in fact, there's little evidence that there's going to be much change in Iraq for quite a while, and he wants to send 30,000, or plans to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. So we're, you know, we're in for a tough, you know, a tough few years here, I'm afraid.
Well, but the one thing though that I don't want to contradict what you were saying earlier is that all of the hopes for change that were brought along with this guy and what he brought in terms of new politics, new campaign financing, which was based upon people, not on the plutocrats, the way he's energized the young. I don't want to give up on this guy because he's just arrived in town. You can see how the environment there is so hostile and it's so corrupt and crony-ridden that he's going to need people at his back. Whether you're at his back to keep him on the straight and narrow, on his back to show that there are people out there in a democracy that actually support this guy as opposed to a handful of southern senators who are living the Reagan legacy.
Well, that's certainly true. I don't mean to be negative. I'm just pointing out that there's a lot to be concerned about because there's not only with the economy but also in foreign policy. And I just think that people, as you said, people need to both support him. But also stay on his back because.
Well, we did it last week. We had a piece on the Afghan war with Pierre Spray, who was on Bill Moyers. It couldn't have been more pessimistic.
Right.
So it's not as if we're not providing the public with the best possible up to date facts and letting the chips fall as they may. We're not cheer squad for anybody here.
Right.
I thank you so much for joining us. I thank the producer Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer Elliot Fong, the engineer Melissa Figueroa, and this program's available at ianmasters.org.